Hi, I'm Stephanie. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is July 1st, 2004, and Midtown is my home group, and I have a sponsor. And I can thankfully say that I am sponsored, actively sponsored. And in fact, I'm proud to say that you're going to hear my sponsor in about a month, and hopefully I'll be back down here. But I'll tell you a little bit about, you know, what it was like, what happened, and what I'm like now. And, you know, one thing I want to make sure I do is I really do want to talk about the solution, you know. And I'll tell you, if there's anything that I want to convey, it is that Alcoholics Anonymous has 100% saved my life, you know. And the life that I have today is certainly not the life that I would have chosen, you know. It is not the life that, you know, 5 years ago I would have said, you know, that's what I want to be doing, you know. Because I don't think I was capable of picturing what life could be like, you know. And there's a passage in the Big Book, and I am not, I'm very bad at quoting the Big Book, so I'll paraphrase as best I can. But it talks about when we're drinking that the life that we know is the only normal one, you know. And so that's why I could never tell you that I wanted to be where I am today, you know. And, okay, so I started drinking when I was about 15, you know. And when I say drinking, I mean, you know, the way that we drank. I mean drinking for as a solution, you know. My first drink, I don't remember my first drink. I don't remember my first drunk, you know. I remember being 5 years old. And even the reason that I remember I was five is because we lived in one house when I was five and one house when I was six. And we were in this house. But I used to run and go get my dad beers, Black Label beers. I don't know what five-year-old remembers the type of beer, you know. But it was Black Label beer. And I would go and I would get it out of the drawer and I would shake it up. And my dad would open it, and he'd be pissed off because, once again, you know, the, you know, five-year-old child, you know. So he would hand me the beer, and I would suck all the foam off the beer, you know. And I can tell you, I have an older sister. She's, you know, 4.5 years older than I am. And she doesn't remember the Black Label beer, you know. And I don't think that she was sucking the foam off the beer and looking forward to that. And that's why she would go hang out with her dad in the garage, you know. So, you know, that's kind of the kind of kid I was. And I'll tell you, before I started drinking, again, this is something that I didn't know that this wasn't normal, but I felt really uncomfortable, you know. I always felt, I was that kid that would do anything to please you, you know. And the lies and the stealing came very, very early and very soon. You know, I wanted what you had, so I would take it, you know. And I remember, you know, stealing, like, money out of people's pencil boxes. I remember going into school with a grapefruit that had rotted in my locker, you know. I was unmanageable even then, you know. But I had a grapefruit that had rotted in my locker, and I told everybody that it was a special Huguenot frog, and I was bringing it to science class for whatever, you know. I mean, and that's just whatever story, whatever embellishment, whatever I could do to, like, surround me and get the attention and be in the middle, you know. And you know, we moved to Roanoke, Virginia when I was, you know, when I was 10, we moved around for a couple of years. We moved to Roanoke, and I want to say that because there's something about when I drive down here, you know, I'm from Arlington. When I drive down here, that it really just feels like, you know, the mountains, there's something very, very homey and warm in my heart, you know, about anywhere outside of Northern Virginia in Virginia, you know. But, you know, moved to Roanoke, and, you know, again, just an uncomfortable kid, you know, was definitely, didn't get into too much trouble, you know, just the constant liar, you know. But when I was 14 or 15 years old, you know, and I started experimenting with alcohol, you know, that was when I actually felt like I could breathe. You know, and I, even though I don't remember my first drunk, you know, I remember intuitively not going to, you know, Courtney's house because her parents were Mormon and there was nothing there. There weren't even, like, cigarette butts that we could, like, you know, smoke the little nub off of, you know. But if I went to so-and-so's house, and I always think it's funny that I don't even remember those friends, but I remember that Courtney, whatever her last name is, you know, and I do remember her last name, her parents were Mormon, there was nothing in her house. Like, that's just the way that my mind thinks, you know. And you know, there was definitely drinking in my family, you know. There was always lots of alcohol at my house, you know, and I just got to the point where if I couldn't go to some place to get it, I would just steal it from my dad, you know. And from a very young age, there was always this thing about drinking in my house. Like, my mom was the one saying, drinking, and my dad was like, drinking, you know. And so it was, I figured out very, very quickly that if I took my dad's alcohol, he wasn't going to get mad at me for it, because he really wasn't supposed to have that much to begin with, you know. And I intuitively just knew where it was, you know. And he had it stashed all over the place, you know, and you know, his drinking is his drinking, so I'll leave that alone, you know. But I would find it, and I would take it, and I would know, like, those big, you know, double gallons of vodka, you know, I would know that there would be no repercussions, you know. And so I started to drink, and I started to feel more comfortable, you know. And what I also started to do, which I just didn't care about, was I started to run through my parents' lives like a tornado. You know, and I started to, you know, I was sneaking out every night. You know, the people that I went to high school and junior high school with, they just weren't cool, you know. So it was like the dropouts. And then this would be a common theme throughout my life. You know, I would find a guy who was in jail or had just gotten out of jail. Because I, again, intuitively knew that if you had done something that was going to land you in the state penitentiary for a couple of years, you probably drank like I did and did the things that I wanted to do, you know. And the only reason that I say that is because I really sought what the book says is lower companions. And for me, it was people that really, in my heart, are just like I am, you know. I was the type of girl who would, you know, sneak drugs into jail, you know, because I knew that as soon as they got out, maybe they would just love me and give me what I wanted. You know, I was the type of girl who, you know, it was kind of hard when you're in junior high, high school, you know, to find people that really drank like I wanted to drink, you know. At least it was hard for me, you know. And so I intuitively knew that if the guy that I was talking to on the phone in jail put the phone down to go do whatever, you know, and another guy picked up, hey, when are you getting out? Whoever was getting out first, that's who I was meeting up with, you know? And that was like my, like, you know, now they have like eHarmony and like all this. That was my criteria, you know? Online didn't really exist then, but I didn't have to do that. And, you know, and there did become many times, you know, and when I think back about high school, you know, I think back about, you know, I know this is a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, but I think about being high on other substances and pushing my mom really hard right in front of the stairs, you know. I think about my mom, who was a school teacher, you know, in our county, you know, and I think about just all the chaos that I would raise. I think about her having to go into high school parties, you know, at 3 a.m. and to get me out of there, you know. I think about her waking up in the middle of the night and not knowing where I am, you know. I think about her, you know, knowing that when the phone rang at 3 a.m. that I was just going to sneak out, you know, knowing where I was, trying to do everything she possibly could, you know, trying to get me involved in, you know, church groups, trying to get me involved in, like, dance and cheerleading and desperately keeping me active in these things. And what I would do, you know, is I would say, all right, I'm going to go to dance class. I'm going to go to ballet. And I would go to my friend's house and get drunk and high, you know, and that's just what I did. And, you know, I didn't think it was any big deal. You know, I had the nickname Hell on Wheels, and I loved it, you know. My parents, about the time that I entered high school, my sister had gone off to college, and she was doing really well. She was in swim meets all across the country, you know, and she went to Olympic trials, I mean, Pan Am Games, all this stuff, you know. And I would do whatever I could, because I heard my mom on the phone one day, and maybe it was when I was 10, 15, I don't know when it was, but I heard my mom on the phone one day, and my dad had said it to me a ton of times, is, we don't want to treat you any different, you know. we don't want you to feel any different. You know, like when your sister's name is in the paper or in Sports Illustrated, you know, like we don't want you to feel any different. And man, this alcoholic latched on. I was like, here is my key. You know, like some kids talk about, my parents got divorced, so I could kind of use that against me, you know. And the way I thought, and I certainly don't mean to offend anybody that did go through that, was like, you know, I don't have that. I can't use something like that as an excuse, but I can use my sister being so successful. And hopefully I will remember to talk later about that amends process and what that is, what my relationship with my sister is like today. But just speed it up a little bit. So my mom filled out my college applications, you know, and my mom wrote my personal statement. My mom got into college. I went, you know, and the first day I was at school, I was stealing my roommate's little pouch. You know, that little, like, bohemian-looking pouch. I knew what was in there, you know. There was money and other substances in there, you know, and I was stealing her pouch, and I was helping her look for it, you know. And I'll tell you, I absolutely hated that college, and there was nothing wrong with that college. You know, I hated the fact that I was so far away from the people that I drank with. That's the truth. And so I made up lies. I said that I had been attacked on campus. I took a hammer to my face to try to, like, bruise myself up a little bit, and my body, too, you know. And I went to campus police, and I said that I had been attacked, and I called my parents, and I told them what had happened, and my dad was terrified, my mom was terrified, and they couldn't wait to get me out of there. And so then when I told them that I was going to go to Blacksburg, Virginia Tech, they were thrilled, they were excited for me, and I got my way. I was 45 minutes away from the people that I, you know, that I had been in high school and that I had drank with, and I also had a whole host of other people. And even at that point, even at like 17 or 18 years old, it was too much for me to go into a party and to make friends, you know. I mean, it's not like you can't find people that drank like me on the college campus, you know. It's not like I couldn't do that. But I was already too tired, you know what I mean? And, you know, I spent another 10 years drinking. But college, you know, there's really not much to say about college. I mean, other than the fact that, you know, every single relationship I had, you know, I tried to live the double life. Every single woman that I lived with, every single, you know, guy that I dated, every single, you know, man or woman in my life, I wreaked havoc through. You know, and I would steal from people. I can actually proudly say today that I'm rebuilding those relationships. And you know, it's not me. As soon as I said that I'm rebuilding those relationships, I was like, it's not you. That God is rebuilding those relationships in my life, you know. But the type of roommate I was, just to give you an example, was I was living with my best friends, you know, the girls that I drank with, and we were getting ready to go to Cancun on spring break, and, you know, one of my roommates came home, and she just had bags and bags and bags and bags full of clothes that she had just bought, you know, and then she, you know, she just left them there. She showed us the stuff she got, and she left them there, and she went out, you know. Well, I picked up the bags, drove to Valley View Mall, returned everything, got stuff that I wanted, came home, you know, a couple days later, she's like, where's all my stuff? You know, I mean, she was like, did I leave it in the car? Did I, you know, and I helped her look for it. I was used to that, right? Like, oh, let me help you, you know. And, of course, I got found out, you know, and, of course, I lied and lied about it. And, you know, that was towards my senior year. And, you know, by the time that I left Tech, it was time, you know. I had one friend left on that campus, and I have no idea why she stuck by me other than the fact that she spent a large part of her college career in Switzerland studying abroad, you know. And I just felt dirty. I felt dirty when I left school, you know. I felt like there was so much of that I just wanted to leave behind me, you know. And at this point, I was a daily drinker. You know, I wouldn't have told you that I was a daily drinker because I really used that whole guise of, you know, oh, I'm in college, or, you know, it's Tuesday, or, you know, like, I'm hell on wheels, remember? Or I'm just trying to have a good time. Can't you people leave me alone, you know? But I moved to D.C., and I'll actually tell you how I got the job. That's kind of interesting. But I you know, I had no plans for after college. And the only reason I got a job is because I was in a bar one night, and everybody was talking about interviewing. It was really annoying, you know. Everybody was talking about what they were going to do, and, you know, graduation was quickly upon us. And I was just like, well, I'm just going to go to graduate school, right? That's the easiest thing to do, you know. And I hadn't filled out application one, you know, but I was going to just go to graduate school come the fall. And, you know, and I was flirting with this guy at this bar, and he was like, well, hey, I'm here to interview. And I'm like, really? Great. He's like, yeah, why don't you come by tomorrow morning at 9 a.m., you know? And somehow I made it, and somehow I ended up getting the job, and it was with a really large consulting firm, and, you know, and it was this really actually amazing job, which I would 3 years later get fired from and escorted from the building. However, I was really happy for myself at the time, you know? And I thought that this was it. You know, I was going to move to D.C. I was going to be this metropolitan girl. You know, I was going to drink those fancy drinks and, you know, and I'll tell you, because I had so many experiences of failing no matter where I went, you know, I got really scared when I was getting ready to move up here. And, you know, my parents drove me up here and, you know, the 5-year boyfriend, came with me. And, you know, I remember when they were done, you know, I was officially like moved in. There was really nothing else to do except for everybody to drive home. You know, I got really afraid. And, you know, I remember for just a couple of minutes, just kind of that paralysis until I remembered that there was a mini mart downstairs, you know. And I went downstairs and I got what was my drink. It was that double bottle, that magnum of wine, you know, whatever the cheapest thing that they had, you know. And I got a Cosmo because I didn't have cable yet, and I was fine. I was fine, you know. And I quickly got into that, you know, corporate culture where, you know, they did things on Thursday and Friday nights. And I did things with them on Thursday and Friday nights, and I drank every single night. And I found a roommate who worked at a hotel, and she was the night shift, so she never saw me, except for occasionally she would, you know, peel me up off the floor. And I drank like that for 2 years, you know. And to me, life was absolutely miraculous, you know. I was skin and bones. I wasn't eating, and to me that was even more miraculous, you know. I was a very sick girl, very sick girl. And, I would lie my way through every single deadline. I would lie, and I don't really know how any of that happened. You know, I mean, God maybe to let me hit my bottom, probably. You know, but you know, there had always been a lot of very near misses. You know, but that was when the very near misses really started to hit home. You know, I was in a very, very bad car accident. You know. Where literally the side of the tree was like on my, like right here on my face, and had it been inches, you know. And to me, I just walked away. The guy I was with got a DUI, whatever. He's got to go to jail. I'm gonna go home, you know. So many times that I had driven home and like taken off a side of my car and taken off, you know, a couple of rearview mirrors, and wow, I just thought of amends. But so I did. I just thought, I was like, oh, hold on, you know. But I took off a lot of rearview mirrors, you know, and that was just normal to me. It was normal to me for my car to be impounded, you know. It would happen every 3 months because I worked in the city, and I would literally come 2 a.m, get dressed, drive to work, and just park wherever. And they don't like that in D.C., you know. Thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars, you know, to the impound lot. And, you know, but that, you know, that was just the way life was. No big deals. No big deals, you know. But in 2000, and I got sober in 2004. In 2000, I hit my bottom. Good. I didn't talk to the drunk log too long. In 2000, I hit my bottom. I got a DUI, which was just to be expected, you know. I mean, and I can't tell you that I was like, whew, finally got a DUI, you know. But it just... I'll tell you, I blew what I blew, and the cop was surprised. I was talking to the cop. I remember talking to the cop. I was crying, you know. That didn't work. I got in the back of his car, you know, and I went to jail. And I didn't know that I was going to see that same holding cell 6 or 7 other times in the next 4 years. You know, I had no idea. And but I sat there, and there was another girl about my age that came in, you know, and she was crying and all upset and, like, just, like, I mean, she had problems, you know. And so she called her mom, and she called her sister, and she's like, I don't know what's going on. I can't believe this. I had 3 drinks. I'm like, me too, you know, 3 bottles, but whatever, you know. And she was calling people. I didn't call a soul. No way. Are you kidding me? Because that would mean that people would question my drinking. Uh-uh. I'll just sit there, because I know they've got to let me out, right? Because half the people I'm hanging with got DUIs, or a couple of them, you know, and I know the drill, you know. And so I sat there, and you know, from Arlington County Jail, again, I did not know that I would be making this phone call multiple times. I called in sick to work, you know. Not from, this is after they'd already, you know, personal recognizance or something. I would never hear those words again, like released on your own personal recognizance. For those of you who don't know, that means they just kind of let you out and hope that you come back for court. And I guess usually people do. I didn't, but usually people do. But, you know, I called work, and I just said I was sick, you know, and I went home. And I don't remember if I drank that night. I think I did, but I don't remember. I can't sit here and tell you that I did. But the next night, you know. And it was about that time that that incomprehensible demoralization started hitting in. And the girls that I was living with, you know, were girls that had kind of given me a chance. They knew me from school, you know, but the rent was so expensive that they let me move into their house. And, you know, but finally they just said, we're done. We're done. We can't deal with this anymore. They had called my parents, you know. They had suggested I go to therapists, and I definitely tried therapists. We actually were living in a parsonage, you know. For those of you who don't know, it's the parsonage is owned by the church. You know, most of these churches have a house that the minister lives in. Well, the minister didn't live there, and they were renting it out, and so we rented it, you know. And so when I would feel desperate and dirty, you know, I would just go over and, you know, sit in a pew on a Sunday morning and hope that it would fix me, you know, and it didn't. But so I found a roommate online. I thought this was a good idea, you know. And normally I think that the people that are, you know, coming to new cities, finding people, or the people that are getting the roommates online are afraid. Well, this girl who threw herself out there online should have been afraid, because she ended up moving in with me. You know, and over the course of 6 months, I stole $23,821 from her. You know, it was par for the course. You know, I've been stealing. If I didn't mention it, thief, cheat, liar, you know. I lied and cheated my entire way through college. That is how I graduated from college. I got on the honor board in honor. I was made honor roll and dean's list every semester, so it's cheating. But I got on the honor court in college so I could figure out how they figured out that people were cheating, so I wouldn't get caught. You know, and I guess that worked well for me. But anyways, to sum it up, I was stealing her credit card. We were out one night, and she actually is a very kind, loving person who I do not have any contact with today. And I do hope one day that that my higher power puts her in my path. But I'll just have to wait and see on that one, you know. But I stole her credit card. She asked me if I thought it was a bad idea that she had her birthday as her PIN number. And I said, no, not at all. And, you know, within a week, I had her PIN number and her card, you know, and I would just take it from her and I'd slip it right back in, you know. And I would steal, you know, clothes from her, jewelry from her. You know, I would steal a ton of stuff from her. And, you know, finally she got wise to it. And, you know, and I was arrested for multiple felonies. And I went to jail for a couple of months, you know. And during that time, you know, it never occurred to me that the way I was living was wrong, you know. I was, my idea of showing up for work was just sitting there, you know, and just staring at my computer for as many hours as I could get away with, you know, and then leaving as soon as I could. As soon as somebody turned their back, I would leave, you know. My job was on a thread, you know, my relationship with my boyfriend, who actually is my husband now, you know, was, I wasn't a true girlfriend, you know. My relationship with my friends was solely based on, you know, when can we go drink. And I obviously did not have the capability to be a good roommate, you know, or even know what that was, you know. So, but I really, when I went to jail, I felt like a desperate dog, you know. I felt like a caged animal, and I felt like, I mean, I was a caged animal. But, you know, I felt like, just get me out of this. Just get me out of this. How can I get out of this? I didn't really think about what was going on or, you know, I just felt like a caged animal. And I, man, when I was in jail, I lied to everybody. I told them I was in there for computer fraud because I figured that was, like, more white collar than, you know, just plain old grand larceny, you know. And I was so delusional that, and this was about the time that I was escorted out of, you know, Arthur Anderson's building with my badge. Thank you, and your keys, you know, because I didn't really suit their corporate culture anymore. You know, the whole, I tried to take disability, actually, for leaving for 2 months to go to jail, but that didn't fly. No, I had the paperwork all filled out and everything. But, more charges. But, anyways, you know, so I was in jail for a couple of months, and when I was there, you know, I was opening up the newspaper with a highlighter, circling the classified ads, you know, going down to the library, typing up my resume, you know, thinking I was going to, like, fax it out from Arlington County Detention Center, you know. You know, but really, I was doing, you know, I was picking up trash on the side of the road. You know, I was in my orange jumpsuit because they let me do work release, you know. And I'll tell you, I was in my Mecca because all the men that drank like me were out there, you know. And this is really how I thought. Like, I would be on the bus. Like, they'd get us all on the bus to go pick up trash, all in our orange jumpsuits. And I used to fan my hair across the seat, you know, maybe wasting the femininity, you know. I mean, my ego was absolutely out of control, you know. Even in jail, I was just like, there ain't nothing wrong here. I'm going to get out of this. It's going to be all fine, you know. And I finally did get out on house arrest, and me and a deputy and a breathalyzer all went to my house. And you guys can imagine how long I was at home, you know, 72 hours. I'm not sure, you know, but I do know that the first night I was like, they're not going to call. Or even if they do, I'm just going to have a little, you know. And I drank, you know. I drank 2 bottles of wine, and I drank a little bit more and a couple beers, you know. And they called. And I said, Baltimore, you know, and nobody came. So it was like, this is just a shite, you know. And the next night did the same thing, of course, you know. And they came. They came at 3:15 in the morning, you know. And I went kicking and screaming off to jail, yelling, NyQuil, NyQuil, you know. But, but, you know, that didn't really have an effect on me. It didn't make me think about my drinking. It didn't make me, you know, there was no epiphany. There was just the next 4 years of literal, you know, literal heck. I try to watch my language. My drinking got to the point where what I was doing is, you know, the women that I was in jail with told me where their boyfriends lived and worked, and I would go find them, you know. And I found myself in places, you know, in the depths of D.C. that I never thought I would be, you know. I found myself in dingy, disgusting hotel rooms with dingy, disgusting people, you know. I'm the type of person that would go to a job fair with the intention of finding a job, and it would be at, like, some big, fancy hotel, and I would end up at the bar and then upstairs, you know. And that's just who I was, you know. And I remember those drives home, you know. I remember losing my jobs, you know. I remember all that stuff, but you know what? It wasn't enough. And it literally became normal to me. And a vacation for me was having 2 abscessed wisdom teeth, going to the emergency room or different emergency rooms, getting some prescriptions for my teeth, and taking a week off of work because I had prescriptions and I had alcohol, you know. And I lived in a 1-bedroom apartment, and it was too much for me to walk from the living room to the bedroom. And we're talking a 1-bedroom apartment in Northern Virginia, you know what I mean? So I would just pull out the sofa bed, you know, and I would live like that for days on end. And I would have told you that everything was fine. You know why? Because when I got out of jail, guess what I did? I applied to graduate school, you know, and I learned, I was like, I'm okay. I got a job. I got another job, you know. I got into graduate school, and ain't no problems here, you know. And I couldn't even go out anymore. Like, you know, my husband's friends would come into town from Boston, you know, and we'd all, you know, going to go out and have a couple drinks on the town. I couldn't even make it to that. I would make it to the bar and have one drink, and everyone would be so confused of what had happened. Did you not eat dinner? No, I've been drinking for the past 7 or 8 hours by myself, you know, thinking about how much fun tonight's going to be. So basically what happened? In March of 2004, there was another very loud, loud knock on my door, and I knew those loud knocks, you know. I had been arrested many times for probation violations, you know. I mean, I won't get into that, but, you know, my probation officer basically called me Princess, because she was like, oh, Princess, how nice to see you. You know, we're glad you decided to show up, you know, and then the cuffs would go on. And that was really the next 4 years. But this one night, there was that very, very loud knock. I had stopped paying restitution, you know, part of that $21,000. I just figured, kind of like the whole breathalyzer thing, that they're not going to come, you know. And this is really the way I lived. I really believed this. And they did come. And they did arrest me. And I found myself once again, you know, in 5B in Arlington County. And I didn't understand what had happened, you know. And this time, something was different. And, you know, the something that was different was that I said a prayer, you know. But I was waiting to go into court for the second time around. On the second day, the first day, the judge was just like, no, I don't have time to deal with this, you know. So the second day, you know, I called my parents, as soon as I was arrested. And my dad said, you know what, leave her there. Click. You know, and I just remember my heart sinking. And, you know, I called back again, and my mom picked up the phone. And you know, my mom talked to me, and my mom was like, I'll be right there. And, you know, what I've come to understand in sobriety is the wedge that puts between two people who have been married for decades, you know. I owed $17,000 at that point. My dad had just gotten a little bit of inheritance money, you know, and they were going to use it to pay off the house partly to pay off the house. And my mom went to the bank because she could, and she got a $17,000 cashier's check. And I'm going to say this now because there have been talks where I have forgotten to say this. But in a year and a half, I will be 100% paid off of that $17,000 with my dad, you know. And every single – I even get chills when I think about it because I know how much this means to him. Every single month at the beginning of the month, I go and I get a card, you know. And he doesn't like those – I love you, Dad. He doesn't like those cushy cards. He likes those funny cards, you know, those, like, crazy, hard-to-find, like, have you rolling on the floor, you know, for, like, weeks cards. And I put a check in there. And I have done that ever since I've been about a month sober, you know. And I'll tell you, those cards, it's not the money, but those cards mean the world to him. But anyways, so obviously I got out of jail. And obviously, you know, my mom put a big wedge between her and my father to do that. You know, she drove up about 4 hours, got me out of jail, and you know, the judge even told her not to do it. And she just looked at the judge, and she was like, what would you do? You know, and the judge is like, you're never going to see that money again. And you know what? At that time, that judge was absolutely 100% right. And the only reason my parents have seen that money again is because there's a power greater than me out there that for some reason has me standing here tonight, you know. But when I got home, I went straight to the fridge and I poured out all the alcohol in the fridge, you know. And I like to point out, not in the house. I wasn't crazy, you know, just in the fridge, you know. But there was something inside of me that was just pulled to do that, you know. And when people talk about, you know, what happened for me was when I was in that holding cell getting ready to go in for the second day to court, I said the Lord's Prayer. It was like the only thing that I could remember, you know what I mean? And it definitely, I feel like that was what has me standing here today. I don't know why, I don't know how, you know, but that stuff doesn't really matter to me, you know? But I got home and I looked up meetings on the internet, you know, and I went to a noon meeting, and I had been to AA before. I remember being to one meeting before, which either maybe a therapist suggested or something, you know, and I remember it was like a round robin kind of meeting, and it got to me, you know, and I just said, my name's Stephanie, and I don't know what I am, and I left, you know, and I lovingly remember a woman following me out, you know, and her giving me her phone number and saying, you know, whatever you need, anytime you need, you know, you can call me. And I was just like, that's weird, you know, okay, thanks, you know, and threw it away. But today, you know, that actually brings a smile to my heart. But I started going to meetings. And, you know, I went to this noon meeting, and I think by, like, my second or third meeting, I met my sponsor. And I met these two women, and Carol and Susan. And Susan is my sponsor today. And they were very patient with me. You know, they asked me how I was doing. I said, that's fine. That's good. That was great. Lunchtime meeting, I'm going to go back up to my office. Carol was like, and I remember you were wearing pearls, and like you had just told us that you had just gotten out of jail and that you had a couple days sober, but you were fine. You know, she's like, you were crazy. I resent that. But I love Carol. But so Carol kind of pushed me over to Susan. And Carol says today, she's like, I did it because she was younger. And I was like, Carol's one of my closest friends today, you know. But she did. She pushed me over to Susan. And somehow Susan intuitively knew that she needed to give me her email address because I wasn't calling nobody. Nobody at all. So maybe she gave me her phone number. But she gave me her email address. And but when she shared in that meeting, and I don't remember what she said, but I do remember that I felt like she was talking to me, you know. And I do remember that I kept going to those meetings, and I quickly got a service position. It was a really small meeting, and they put me as the chair and the treasurer of the meeting, which is a very bad idea. I ended up stealing the treasury and having to make amends for that. I fully made amends for that later. And I actually went into this long spiel about making amends for it. And this old-timer who's not around anymore, I don't know where he is, but he said, shut up and start the meeting. And it's just so, I love it. I love that man, you know. At the time, I was pissed. But you know, but I started going to meetings. And, you know, as I said, it took me about 4 months to get a sobriety date. I had three other sobriety dates. And, you know, I'm really grateful for that time. There's sometimes even when I say that it took me 4 months to get a sobriety date, and I'm like, oh my gosh, that's it. I can't fathom that. I don't, you know, but again, of course I can't fathom it because it's not me, you know. But my first year was basically I got everything I wanted, you know. I got engaged like a month after I started coming around to meetings, and that was my focus, you know. I called Susan from a bar in Boston and told her that I was engaged, you know. And I got engaged May 28th. My sobriety date is July 1st, so let's just clear that up, you know. I called her from a bar, and it was, and, you know, and the only reason I called her, she was the only person that I had to call, you know. She was the only person that I could think of that I had to call. And I had no idea even what a sponsor was, you know. But I had this woman's email, you know, and I started emailing her the things that were happening to me because my drinking actually got worse when I started going to meetings, you know. About the time I got out of jail, you know, I started going to see a psychiatrist and a psychologist and started doing all that to get in church. And, you know, then, well, why not throw AA in the mix is another thing that might fix me, you know. And I really kind of looked at it with that. But slowly but surely, all those things kind of went aside. But I did have this woman's email, and I would just email her my story. And I would email her the things that were happening to me, and I would email her about how I felt about drinking again. At this point, I was going into hallucinations when I was drinking. And, you know, I literally was seeing Jesus and pouring drinks for Jesus and reporting this back to my fiancé. And, you know, he just wrote it up, and we took it into my psychiatrist, you know. But slowly but surely, I started having dinner with you guys, and I started telling you my stories. And you started laughing or smiling or saying, oh, yeah, this is what happened to me, you know. And you started, I related to what you were saying, and you didn't judge me or think I was crazy or look at me weird for what I was telling you. And I started to experience the fellowship, and I started to experience the unity. And I was sponsored at that time, and even though I didn't know it, you know, I was sponsored, and I started getting service positions. You know, and I started walking through the steps with my sponsor. And, you know, the steps for me have been something that I know in my heart today, there is no life problem that I have that cannot be solved by a step. There is nothing that I have found, you know, in my life that can't actually be solved by sitting down and looking at the steps, you know. And the traditions too, you know. But really in the steps, you know. And I did a fourth and a fifth step. And I can tell you that I was as honest as I could have been, and I definitely left some stuff off. And the stuff that I left off came back to bite me in the later years, you know. And I've definitely had to redo those portions of my fourth step, you know, and read them out to my sponsor. I did the sixth and seventh step, you know, and just did it. And then I went on to the, you know, eighth and ninth step. And I'm being facetious by that, but I did it very quickly. I didn't understand it. It was really short. I didn't really get it, you know. The eighth and ninth step I got because it was concrete, and, you know, I was going to have to go find all those ex-boyfriends. Yay, you know, and that didn't happen. But it terrified me, and I can tell you that that I am by no means done with my ninth step amends, but I have made amends, you know, with my mother and my sister and my mother-in-law. A lot of the purple pants girl, well, I guess I didn't say purple pants, but the girl I stole those clothes from today, we actually have a very solid relationship and we talk on a regular basis. And that's crazy to me. That is so crazy to me. 10 years went by, and when I made amends to her, and I had to do it over the phone because she lives way out in Portland, you know, but I wanted to continue the relationship, and I knew that I had to say something. And, you know, she said to me, you know, I've always felt bad about that too. And I was like, this is not how this is supposed to go, you know? But it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. The fact is that I cannot believe that my higher power would put her back in my life, you know? And, it's my experience with amends, just to talk about amends really quickly, is, yeah, I want to find my roommate that I stole that money from. You know, I do want to find her. I do want to really tell her that I live differently today, and that I can't believe the peace of mind that I stole from her. You know, and because I knew her, and we were friends, and I knew that she was taking a big chance, even in her heart of moving to D.C. to find a friend. You know, and of course she moved out of D.C. immediately, and it probably has affected her ability to be able to trust people. You know, but not that I'm that big of a deal, but there's something in my heart that sounds right about that. You know, and but I know that if it's meant to be, that God will put it in my path. I've seen it happen in other people's lives, and it's happened in my life. The only reason I had the ability to make amends to my college roommate that I stole all those clothes from is because her email, her address, her phone number, where she worked, showed up in my inbox one day, along with 50 other names of all the girls that I went to college with and have a ton of amends to make, you know, just showed up in my inbox one day. And so, you know, that is a path that it terrifies me. It terrifies me every time I do it. When I think of amends, I think of hyperventilating in my car before I'm getting ready to walk into a restaurant talking to my sponsor on the phone. You know, I think of the prayers. I think of the partnering up with another person in Alcoholics Anonymous to just write that note, you know, the note that goes with all the money that you stole, you know. So, you know, I think about that. I think about me and my pigeons walking around my house, gathering up all of the stuff that I stole because I just needed to do it. And it was so hard for me to do it that we were having a pigeon meeting one night. And I was like, let's go. Just everything, you know. And hope you can find a message in this. You know? But Destiny well remembers that. But being able just to show up for life, you know, and my relationship with my father today, you know, is and my mother and my sister. Oh my gosh, I hated my sister when I came in here. I hated her. You know, she was a doctor. She married a doctor. You know, all that swimming stuff. You know, all this education that she had, and you know, the big house, and she's pretty. That killed me. But today, like, she's so excited that my husband and I are coming to spend Christmas with her. And I am so excited to be there, you know. I made amends with her at 6:30 in the morning because I said, anytime you're free, anytime that you have, maybe we could go grab a cup of coffee. She woke me up at 6:15 in the morning, and she said, you want to go get coffee? I'm like, course. And you know it's too early to call your sponsor. Like, I'm not, or maybe it's about, I'm not calling Susan that early. But plus, at that point, we'd already talked about that. But, you know, and I do want to talk about 10, 11, and 12. My inventory is something that I've really struggled with taking it like it says in the big book. You know, and I'm certainly not going to stand here and say that every night, you know, I turn over and I reflect on, you know, my day scorecard. But it is very, I know I cannot talk to my sponsor unless I've taken my inventory. It's a waste of her time, you know, and it's a really uncomfortable conversation. So given the fact that I talk to my sponsor, probably, I actually get her on the phone probably every other day, I've got to be looking then. You know, and sometimes it's that spot check that I hate doing when I'm driving on 495 getting ready to call her because I need to call her. It's that checkbox inventory. Sometimes it really is, all right, what's going on? You know, and the thing that I use is I use the big book. I use the questions. I think they're on page 87, I think. You know, and I use the questions, you know, and I think the biggest thing that really helps me in taking my inventory is, have I made any mistakes today? Do I have anyone I need to apologize to? That's how I interpret it. You know, and prayer and meditation is a big part of my life. You know, I get on my knees at night. I'm working on getting on my knees in the morning, you know, and that didn't come easy. That's not something like I all of a sudden did. You know, that was something that came at about, you know, 3 years sober. I finally started getting on my knees at night, you know, and I'm so grateful for that habit, because even last night when I was sitting in bed, you know, I didn't get on my knees, and I was, like, laying in bed, my book and my cat, my blankets, and I'm like, I just need to get out of bed. I get back out of bed, and I get on my knees, you know, because it, and I don't think that there's any way that you have to pray. It does not say in the big book, at least I don't think so, that you have to get on your knees, but for me, it's what I've seen other people do, monkey see, monkey do. I think it's Johnny H. that says you just got to pick the right monkey, you know, and I know in my heart that I've picked the right monkey, and my monkey, Susan would love that, you know, my monkey gets on her knees. I've seen her do it, you know. We've gone on trips together and things like that, and I've seen what she does, you know, and the 12th step, the 12th step. There was a time when I just thought the 12th step was about doing service, having a service position, which is really important, you know, getting involved if you can, and, you know, I mean, whatever service structure is available in your area, whatever, you know, or in your meetings, or, you know, one of the things I've really struggled with service is trying to find a service position that will give me the limelight, you know, it's the titled service position, and, you know, not wanting to do the pick up cigarette butt service position, which I do have on Tuesday night now, you know. But that's one thing that I've really kind of had to check myself with. And but making sure that I'm involved, making sure that I have service, you know, making sure that the women that I sponsor are involved in service, you know. That was done for me. Why wouldn't I do that for somebody else, you know? And there were so many times when, you know, I'd be on the phone with my sponsors and be like, how many service positions do you have? And the only time I don't like that question is when I don't have any, you know? Or when I have one, but it's like once a month, you know, like every other Thursday or something, you know? And I'll tell you, it's not about the position. It's about giving back. It's about the unity that brings. And I can't tell you how many friendships have been developed with, you know, making coffee or picking up butts or, you know, I mean, one of my first service positions that I actually developed a really close friend in AA with was making coffee, you know. And, you know, but it's more than that. The 12 step to me is more than that. You know, it's truly practicing this in everything that I do, you know. And when I was new, the barometer that I used was, if I'm at work, you know, and I'm getting ready to tell my boss a lie, and I know I really struggle with lying to my boss. If I'm getting ready to do that, you know, I'm going to pretend that Susan's here. That's what I did when I was new, you know. And I know now that, you know, it's just like in my second and third step, like finding a higher power, you know, that it really was, first it was AA, you know, and my sponsor, you know, and now it truly is a higher power. I have a funny little higher power. Morgan Freeman, for some reason, is my visualization of a higher power. I'm not kidding you. Emily knows this is true. I was in Ireland, and I really needed God. And I don't know if I had just watched that movie, I don't know, Bruce Almighty or something, but I was on a plane and in a car, and I just remember thinking, I was on a plane, and I remember thinking, help, you know, God, help me. And this visual of Morgan Freeman in a white suit with a white tie just came into my mind. And so, you know, but the point, the message, you know, is that I carry that with me. I really do. And, you know, sometimes when and instead of now picturing my sponsor standing there, I really do picture God standing there, my version of God, you know. And I'll tell you that helps me. You know, but it helps me remain principled, because if I don't remain principled in everything that I do, and I'm not sitting here saying that I do, you know, but if I don't at least make an effort to remain principled in the things that I do, I'm going to drink, you know. There are so many bad actions that I've taken in sobriety. There are so many times where I've stopped taking my inventory because I don't want to write it down. There's so many times when I've taken my inventory and not written it down. There's so many times when I've taken my inventory, written it down on another page, so I don't have to see it when I go to talk to Susan, which is weird. But, you know, but I get to the point where I feel like I'm going to drink, and I've definitely been there in sobriety. And it is always, always, always based on the fact that I'm being dishonest, that I'm carrying a resentment around, you know, and that I'm not talking about it, and I'm slowly drifting away. And just to talk about, 6 and 7, really quick, I have a minute. Oh, my gosh. In the past year, so basically, you know, yeah, in the past year, 6 and 7 has finally started to, there's been a door that's opened a little, you know, and the way that I'm not going to say that I fully understand it, you know, but knowing when I'm not going to give up, you know, 6, and being willing to, 6 is an attitude to me. It's just being willing, you know, it's being willing to talk about it, because I'm a very flawed person, you know. I really like to look good on the outside and have you think that everything's okay, you know, but I'm just another garden variety alcoholic. I'm not, like, so flawed that I'm, like, way over here, you know, but there are things that I hold on to, you know, and I thank God that my sponsor knows them, that my friends know them. You know, my friends sometimes can take one look at me, you know, and know what's going on, you know, and know that I'm being dishonest in this area again, you know. But I think it's an attitude to have that taken away from me. And when I think of 7, I think of seeking to do God's will, you know. And if I can do that, if I can just try to be one of God's kids, you know, then I'll probably be able to stay sober that second, you know. And I'm really grateful for what I have here. I am so grateful for my sponsor. I'm very grateful for strong sponsorship being really pummeled into my head when I was new. And I love that. I say pummeled proudly, you know, loudly, and, you know, because without that relationship, that is my foundation, you know, my, you know, graduate school, my job, you know, and even my relationship with my husband. Those are the branches. But my foundation is Alcoholics Anonymous. My foundation is my relationship with a higher power. And my foundation is my relationship with my sponsor. So I really appreciate you guys taking the time to listen. Thank you.